Thank you for coming back to 10 Minutes with Tony for more incredible insight on the war in Afghanistan, past, present, and future, as it has now been more than a week that we've watched this completely chaotic disaster of getting U.S. troops, civilians, and Afghanis out of that country. This is a special double edition of 10 Minutes with Tony. Yes, that's correct. It's going to be 20 minutes as I continue my in-depth conversation with Army combat veteran William. Let's talk some more about the Afghanistan Army and the Afghans, people that worked hand in hand, side by side with the U.S. military. Were they capable of defending themselves? Did they want to defend themselves? What do you think about how this ended so abruptly, meaning on their part?
I just want to preface this answer here with the comment, and that is 70 to 80% of the guys that we served with, meaning the Afghan counterparts, took their patriotism and their willingness to fight very seriously. So I don't want to have this misconception that none of them wanted to fight. There were real guys there that really stood up for what they believed in and paid the ultimate sacrifice along with us. We owe those people a heck of a lot for everything they did and everything they sacrificed. We cannot, in good conscience, leave those people there to die. But I think there was a certain amount of dependency that they had on us to say, hey, you know, we're kind of your training wheels. Started out with the U.S. very much being the tip of the spear. And then within a couple of years, we were sort of shifting gears from a high tempo combat operations to more of a support. So we would follow the Afghan units into some of these conflicts and firefights. And we would kind of stand back and see how they handled themselves. And for the most part, they did as best as they could. And when we talk about, you know, their loyalties to their country, you know, I'm an American. So everything I've been given is because of where I was born. Think about an Afghan soldier. You're making probably $2 a day. You know, you're holding an AK-47 and you're just trying not to get killed. What has the Afghan government ever given you that's going to make you toe the line and fight these guys? And the answer is nothing.
That's a really, really good point that the average American probably doesn't understand, because when the president came out and said the Afghans basically folded, mm-hmm. It certainly didn't help that their president left the country. A lot of listeners that I heard from on the open mic, that was kind of the image that they had, is the Afghans, you know, don't even want to fight for themselves.
Yeah, most Americans have never been on the wrong end of a machine gun. So it's easy to sit there and kind of, you know, Monday morning quarterback this thing when, you know, they haven't heard the sound of an RPG before.
Exactly. And every single person like you that I have heard from on various news channels and news shows have all said that. It took time for us to give them the weaponry, and it took time for us to train them. And every person like you, like I said, that I've heard from has talked about how those people were proud and fought proudly. And I mean, 60,000 plus of them gave their lives over the course of the 20 years. When the Afghans were fighting alongside the Americans, they probably had a lot more confidence than they did when we were leaving and they had a fight on their own.
That's absolutely the case. You know, POTUS had said in his briefing that was like, you know, we wanted to pull the Band-Aid off. And it's like, well, buddy, you know, you didn't pull the Band-Aid off. You pulled off the tourniquet. We were the only thing holding them together, and they were not ready. And there were no indications that they were ready. I've heard a lot of people talking about the machine guns. You've seen the pictures and the videos, of course. You know, the Taliban guys are in possession now of thousands of units of machine guns and M4s and RPGs and helicopters. And everyone's like, well, why do they have access to that? How come we didn't take them with us? Those weren't ours. We signed those over to the Afghan government. So that was officially the property of, you know, the Afghan National Army and the Afghan National Police. So when they folded, you know, it was their property that then became in possession of the Taliban, and it's unfortunate. And they can't say that they weren't equipped. It's hard to say that $124 billion over 20 years didn't pay off for them.
People have been saying, based on exactly what we are talking about, you know, this is not the same Taliban that was there when we first went there. This is an organization that is as well equipped as some small countries are. This makes me worried about the safety of not only America, but other parts of the world, because I don't care what anybody says about the Taliban cooperating. I'm not buying any of that.
Right. You know, another thing I kind of just wanted to dispel, and I'm glad you brought it up, is an Apache helicopter is not a Jetta. You don't just hop in and start it up and take off. So it's not to say that eventually that these guys won't have the capability to fly these craft. But right off the bat, I don't see that as being a direct threat. And I just kind of wanted to put that out there. There's a conception that Taliban is already doing gun runs over villages and stuff, and they have no idea what they're dealing with. 98% of them are illiterate and uneducated. And maintain, not just fly, right? The maintenance that goes into a UH-60 helicopter, you know, not so much sky is falling, right? But it is is a possibility and a threat, but it's not an immediate imminent threat. Does that make sense?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. And that's somewhat reassuring. You're saying some of what they have is so sophisticated, they're not going to be able to use it, at least right away.
That would be like me saying, hey, Tony, here's a helicopter. Here are the keys. Can you get it off the ground?
Right.
You know, and not only that, get it off the ground and arm it and load it and fuel it. And hey, the GPS went out. You know, are you a mechanical engineer? Can you fix this? Down the road, there is a threat of foreign adversaries, cough, cough, China, who would have the technical capabilities to instruct those guys on how to use that weaponry. And that is the foreign policy issue that we have to look forward to.
I'm sure they learned a lot along the way.
Absolutely. And that was one of the big things. It's a Taliban kind of a catchphrase or a slogan. And it says, you know, you have the watches and we have the time. Kind of speaking to the Western allies, mm-hmm. that you can come into our country, but we can just wait you out. We can wait and wait and wait. We've been doing it for 1,000 years. You know, we got tired of playing whack-a-mole. And that's kind of how it felt at times. We would get a place secured and then something would pop up over there. So we'd run over there and we'd put that fire out. And then somewhere across the province, something would pop up and we'd jog over there and put that fire out. So they just waited us out. But I just hope that the U.S. decides to start exercising its predator drone policy. You know, what a lot of people don't realize is Barack Obama ordered more drone strikes on enemy targets than any other president in history. And actually, a few of the administrations combined didn't equal his predator drone capability orders. So I've been kind of sitting there, and one of the jokes that's kind of going around amongst the veteran community is like, hey, man, we got all these Taliban guys. They're on TV. They're telling us right where they are, and they're all in the same room. The foreign policy aspect of that is immensely complex, although it shouldn't be. That
right.
should be a battle.
But that is something that we're capable of doing, because the Pentagon is saying if the Taliban stands in the way of Americans getting out of Afghanistan or even Afghan civilians, if the situation goes from bad to worse, we could take out a lot of these people with drone strikes and things like that.
We saw it in Iraq and Syria with ISIS. With the exception of some ground troops and special forces operators, that was largely an air-to-ground war, and it was executed largely with Predator drones. And that was single-handedly how we beat them back to keep that country secure. We did it from the air.
Okay, so it's reassuring that you don't believe there's any real imminent threat now, but as time goes on, this is
right.
going to open up the gates for other terror groups
Absolutely.
To start training again. We already have more troops back in Afghanistan than we were trying to get out to begin with. Don't you think
right.
now?
And it is a necessary evil, though, I will say that.
A year or two or three or five from now, we're going to have to go back in there?
Absolutely. I don't know if we will. The need is already there, right? We're seeing that right now with the way the interpreters are being dragged into the streets and shot for their participation in the resistance against the Taliban. So when you talk about need, you know, kind of how do you define that? In my mind, the need is right now. There's got to be a way to kind of roll this back and take up a position that's more defensive, right? Give the Afghans their training wheels back like we did in Korea. I mean, people talk, oh, it's a 20-year war. It's an endless war. I don't hear anybody complaining about our presence in Germany. 1945, my man. Like, I don't hear anybody complaining about, you know, our presence in Korea, 1954. I don't hear anybody complaining about our presence in Southeast Asia.
I mentioned that my previous podcast, but it seems sensible to me. I think we have like 30,000 troops in Japan. You mentioned Germany.
Mm-hmm.
We have even more troops in Germany for even a longer time. So we have tens of thousands of troops stationed in different places where there were previous wars, right? For the last year or so, there's been 2,500 troops in Afghanistan basically holding down the country, which is essentially holding down the region. So why is it so far-fetched that we wouldn't keep 2,500 or 3,000 troops in Afghanistan just to keep the region stabilized?
And that's such a great point, Tony, and I'm glad you brought it up. When we look at Afghanistan and we talk about combat operations, the boots on ground was the big catchphrase for a little while there. We haven't had a true combat casualty in Afghanistan in over 18 months. So to say that we were there, you know, hitting it hard like we were in 03, 05, 07, is just not the case. We were there very much in a advisory role to the Afghan government. And what people fail to see is the strategic location of that country. Russia saw it. The British saw it. The French saw it. The strategic importance of that region with its proximity to China, Iran, you know, some of the other foreign adversaries we have in the Middle East, Iraq and Syria, even. We're talking about strategic locations where there are people who live and exist, and their only purpose in life is to wake up and try to kill as many of us as they can. I mean, we had missile silos in Turkey for the better part of 25 years during the Cold War. So you know, there's two ways you could have done it, right? And I had this conversation with my wife the other night, and she's, you know, I was kind of upset and emotional and talking about how we should have fought them differently, them being the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And she said, how would you have fought them? And I said, savagely, because savage fighting is all these people have really been able to understand for the last couple thousand years. You talk to veterans, and they felt like they were fighting with one hand tied behind their back. In 2013, at a portion of my deployment there, they turned our mortarmen into cooks. They took away our air support. They took away our ability to engage civilian housing, even if we were taking direct threat from that housing. It was like trying to fight Mike Tyson with no lessons and one hand tied behind your back. It was excruciating to be a part of.
And why in the world would we have done that?
Well, you know, aside from some of the senators and congressmen canceling our breakfasts and our lunches when we were in Afghanistan, that's not a lie. You can fact check that. They completely restructured what's called the rules of engagement that define it's a legal document that outlines and defines the abilities of American soldiers to engage the enemy in combat and fighting that battle, right, with the greatest military in the world and only being allowed to use 2% of it at any given time with justification. Was asinine. It was exhausting. And I think after a while, the Taliban and Al-Qaeda kind of became more emboldened. I was in Kabul at the airport, actually, in 2016, and we were there for the German embassy attack that killed over 300 people. So I kind of got to see the transformation of Afghanistan through the course of this. And like I said, I only went twice, and I'm sure if you talk to guys in 04, 05, 06, you get a very much a Wild West story, right, of how combat operations were run all the way until the mission changed to what they called resolute support.
I do vaguely remember the rules of engagement that you're talking about, the changing of the rules of engagement. Now that you say that, I do vaguely remember that. Mm-hmm. But as you said, these people are savages, right? Chopping off people's heads, cutting off people's limbs, torturing people on YouTube, sending out these videos. So do you feel like the United States has lied to you at all? Do you feel like the government misled you or lied to you at all or lied to the American people?
A soldier on the ground is going to do what we're told. And there is some groans. You hear the new rule come down. You're like, you got to be kidding me, right? But then you put your freaking helmet on, you get in the truck and you go out. You know, one of our most veterans' favorite quotes is from Black Hawk Down, where the guy's kind of who is talking about how once the bullets start flying past your head, all the politics go right out the window. And that was the reality. Every single day we woke up and we're like, look, this is the situation. This is what we have to deal with. And it's hammered into us as soldiers, as airmen, as sailors, that you play the cards you're dealt and you do it to the best of your ability. One thing I just kind of wanted to say here to the veterans that are out there feeling this sort of shame and this disappointment and this grief, the shame isn't ours to bear. And I need people to understand that, hear it, and say it to themselves. The shame isn't mine. You know, I'm not the one that should feel the shame for what happened. It wasn't my decision, like we had heard from some of the senior military personnel. But the shame isn't mine to bear. And for till the day I die, that's going to be the mantra of how I look at my time in Afghanistan.
As an American citizen, though, that watched this for 20 years, I feel like many other average American citizens that if I were someone in your shoes, it's hard to explain, but I can't help to feel bad for the people that serve there seeing this, like just thinking if I were you, how irate and pissed off I would be.
Mm-hmm. It's absolutely true. And that is part of that complex emotion is the anger and the feeling of betrayal a little bit. Right. And it's just one of those things that, like most soldiers, we just compartmentalize and it's going to take time to heal. It sounds ridiculous, you know, safe space and all that kind of stuff.
No, it doesn't sound, now, it doesn't sound it, ridiculous at all.
It's going to take time to heal from this. I work with guys who are, you know, 2- and 3-time Purple Heart winners. I work with a guy whose son was KIA in Afghanistan. So this for me is extraordinarily close to home. And I think the best way I can describe it is it's personal. This is, you know, when you pour your blood, sweat, and tears into something and to see it go as wrong as it has in the last, you know, 72 hours, it's exceptionally personal. And I think that's going to be the thing that most veterans are going to have to put aside. I mean, we sit here and scratch our heads. And yes, we talk about the KIAs and we talk about the suicides. But what we're not talking about yet is the broken homes, the divorce rate amongst veterans, you know, the cost at home of this war, of these conflicts that have been extracted on the U.S. servicemen. And I think it's going to take time for it to settle in. It's going to take time to see past the end of this tragedy and kind of look forward into the future. Mm-hmm. I know when I first saw the news, I was making some calls and I said, who's got a team that's going? You know, like I wanted to, you know, I got a newborn baby girl at home and I got a wife and a fantastic job. And I'm like, let's go. I'm going to go right now. Put me on a plane. I'll be anywhere you want in 24 hours. You know, yeah. And I had to kind of sit there and say, you know, that's just not realistic. You got to kind of sit in it for a little while and process what's happened.
Right. That's your mentality and that's the way you were trained.
Absolutely. Yeah, you don't stop till the mission's done. And I always felt after my time in the service that we always left something unsaid. And I went back as a contractor, as most of us did, as veterans of OEF and the Global War on Terror. You get out of the Army and you go contract with the boys. And even after all of those extra trips I took, right, above and beyond the call for service, I went over as a private citizen and continued to try to push that mission because I believed in what we were doing there. And
see, that's the thing. Most of the people that were serving believed in the mission at the time. But now you can look back and say, what was it really all for? It's easy for someone like me who was not there to say, wow, if I were a soldier, if I were in active duty there, I'd be so pissed off now.
Yep.
But I wasn't there, and I don't know all the things that you did for women there, so much for children there, improved the country so much. So on the other hand, you could say, yeah, I'm really pissed off that this is the outcome, but I still know what I did there and still walk away with that.
And that's really well said. On the geopolitical scale, on the macro scale, this is a devastating loss that the government and her allies are going to feel for decades. That being said, in the year, the 2 years, the 3 years, I know guys that deployed four freaking times. In those years we were there, I made a difference in that small little village. That little girl could go to school and learn arithmetic. That woman could walk down the street without fear of being killed for looking at another man. So I had to kind of take my victory down to the micro scale and say, look, while I was there, this is the change I effected. Did it last? Unfortunately, it did not. But while I was there, those people had a reprieve. And it sucks that we kind of have to, you know, break it and do the long division on that all the way down to that micro point. But that is how I've been able to sleep at night. And that is, again, I'm kind of talking here. I'm new to all this as far as dealing with what's just happened. But I can only assume that that mentality is how I'm going to push through this and be able to let it go.
And that's exactly what I'm saying, Will, because it's easy for the average Joe who wasn't there, wasn't in combat anywhere, wasn't in the military to say, oh, wow, this was all a waste. 2,500 Americans died, and now we're right back to square one. But that doesn't negate everything that's happened over the last 20 years. Yeah, it's easy for people that weren't there and don't really know to criticize the military or whatever.
Right. And it's what we're going to have to hang our hat on. And when we go down to the VFW and the American Legion and we talk to the guys who truly did this first in the Vietnam generation and watch Saigon fall, these guys, man, God bless them every single one. Every time I see one, man, I make a point to go up to them and talk to them. And, you know, they always say, well, thank you for your service, young man, you know, a veteran to a veteran. And I say, hey, man, you went first with less stuff.
Right. Right.
They've been there. They watched the guys clinging to the helicopter taken off of the top of the embassy. And when they came home, they didn't have a flag to be waved. So how fortunate we are. And I think one of the big silver lining takeaways is that at least we come home to that support. I don't think there's a single American right now who's looking at Private Joe Snuffy going, hey, man, you really screwed this for us. It's not pointed at us. And back then, it absolutely was.
Will, I cannot thank you enough for your time, and I cannot thank you enough for your service. I'm sure you and your family made a lot of sacrifice for you to be there and do what you've done.
Thank you so much. And just one kind of quick thing on the way out here. If there are some vets who tuned in, suicide rates in the last 30 days have gone up anywhere from 15 to 20% and are continuing to climb. This is the reality of what we're facing as the veteran community. Please do not be the guy that sits there in his house by himself with all of this. You can't do it by yourself. You know, we didn't fight in Afghanistan as one person. We fought as a unit. So reach out to your unit, being the VA, suicide crisis lines, a friend, other veterans. Reach out and have a conversation that's hard to have and frustrating to have, but have the conversation. Thank you so much, Tony.
There's a lot of resources out there, and we certainly hope that people take advantage of those resources. You mentioned your wife and your child. A lot of people don't have that.
Again, it's just not worth it. It's worth it to pick up the phone. Keep calling until you get an answer.
All right. Well, you take care of yourself. I look forward to speaking with you again and perhaps sitting down and smoking a cigar.
Absolutely, buddy. I look forward to it.
Very, very insightful information from William, and emotional. In fact, after we had that conversation, a little while later, Will texted me and he said, I think that conversation helped me, meaning him, as much as it helps other people. The National Suicide Prevention Hotline, 1-800-273-8255. 1-800-273-8255. Or you can check out Suicide Prevention Lifeline.org. SuicidePreventionLifeline.org. If you are a veteran, if you served in Afghanistan, thank you for your service. Hope it helps you cope with it a little bit better. Again, that's Suicide Prevention Lifeline, 800-273-8255. I'll catch you next time on the next edition of 10 Minutes with Tony.